This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and with me is the 24th Poet Laureate of the United States, Ada Limon. Congratulations again. Welcome again. A million, million, million congratulations to you.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be with you here today.
Ada is the author of 6 books of poems and hosts the podcast, The Slowdown. But today, she's ours. And here's Ada.
Privacy. On the black, wet branches of the linden, still clinging to the umber leaves of late fall, 2 crows land. They say, stop. And still, I want to make them into something they are not. Odin's ravens, the Brujas' eyes. What news are they bringing of our world to the world of the gods? It can't be good. More suffering all around, more stinging nettles and toxic blades shoved into the scarred parts of us, the minor ones, underneath the trees. Rain comes while I'm still standing. A trickle of water from whatever we believe is beyond the sky. The crows seem enormous, but only because I'm watching them too closely. They do not care to be seen as symbols. A shake of a wing, and both of them are gone. There was no message given, no message I was asked to give, only their great absence and my sad privacy. Returning like the bracing, empty wind on the black, wet branches of the linden.
The voice of Ada Limon. How you read. I want to start by talking about how you accepted adoration the night of your inauguration. I cannot forget how you stood there while people just poured love on you and you were so unflappable. What did you feel?
You know, it felt like a moment of healing because it felt like we had been through so much together as a community, as artists, as people who've been so isolated and so divided from one another through the last couple of years, through the pandemic, through so much that we've gone through. And for me, it just felt like a moment where it wasn't about me, but it was about poetry and making art and a togetherness and a sense of community.
Well, there you stood in your red suit, and you were just so unflinching and so calm. Now, I think you're right. There was no ego in that at all. It really was about something else. It was about coming together.
That's how it felt to me.
I now understand that, but I couldn't understand how calm you were because you took yourself out of that. Oh, wow. That's a good answer. Well, it was a night to remember, I'll tell you that. It was a night to remember.
I've never truly was.
Ever seen the audience act like that in my life. Well, I want to start with your poetry, and I want to start with The Big Fake World, my favorite book. I knew you studied drama. And this shows it. Can you just sum up a little bit of the construct? I know you can't read from it, but just tell us a little bit of the rubric of it.
Yeah. I'm so glad you love This Big Fake World because it is also one of my favorites. In fact, it's my stepfather's favorite as well. And it's my second book, but I was writing it at the same time as I was writing my first book, Lucky Rec. And the construct of it is that it's a story in verse, and it's about a man, our hero, who is the man in the gray suit, and he falls in love with the woman at the hardware store after his wife leaves him. And it's about a marriage that's, you know, full of tumult, and then he falls in love, and he doesn't know how to act around the woman at the hardware store, and yet he's madly in love with her.
It is. The locus is the hardware store. But it is so funny because the anti-hero in literature is so effective. And that is it. And where did you get the idea for the drunk Lewis who writes letters to President Reagan? Whatever possessed you?
Yeah. Well, I had this idea of someone who wasn't just obsessed with Ronald Reagan, but really needed to write him letters. And so I wanted this person who was clearly had an addiction issue and was obsessed with writing letters to Ronald Reagan and what they might look like, and wanting a sort of simple life that he believed was the life that Reagan had and portrayed in his movies. But and so he becomes a sort of anti-hero slash elucidator of the story.
The funny thing is that you are so humorous.
Thank you.
Should get the Mark Twain Award for this. It is actually, there's hard humor in it, and there's real social commentary.
Thank you.
It's really hard-hitting about relationships. I don't think it's getting enough notice.
I really appreciate that. Thank you for that.
Why can't it go on stage?
That's a good idea.
We expect a play from you before you're out. I think you'll be a little busy for the next few months, but I think a play is in your future. Do you?
Oh, that would be wonderful. That would be wonderful.
Also, I thought to myself, how freeing is it to work with persona?
I love being able to write in characters sometimes, because I think it's, you know, as artists that deal with the dark night of the soul, if you will, I think sometimes it's nice to take a break and be in someone else's body and someone else's shoes and someone else's mind. And I think it's also a way of observing the world that's, you know, slightly askew. And I think poets can do that really well from inside ourselves, but it also adds another layer when we can do that inside a character. So I really love the freedom that persona can give you as an artist.
And you can get away with murder. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get them to do all your dirty work, right?
That's true.
So you can be as mischievous as you want. And this is showing you at your best with mischief.
Thank you.
So I think we're going to be waiting for that drama. But back to poetry, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress with Ada Limon. I've been waiting all night for this. Let's have another poem.
Yeah. This is a poem for my husband. Against Nostalgia. If I had known back then you were coming, when I first thought love could be the thing to save me after all, if I had known, would I have still glued myself to the back of his motorcycle while we flew across the starless bridge over the East River to where I grew my first garden behind the wire fencing in the concrete raised beds lined by ruby twilight roses? If I had known, it would be you, who even then I liked to look at across a room, always listening rigorously, a self-questioning look, the way your mouth was always your mouth. Would I have climbed back on that bike again and again until even I was sick with fumes and the sticky seat too hot in the early fall? If I had known, would I have still made mistake after mistake until I had only the trunk of me left, stripped and nearly bare of leaves? If I had known, the truth is, I would have kneeled and said, sooner, come to me sooner.
That is Ada Limon. You know, I taught that poem. And the one thing that I thought was significant was the sticky seat. Because if it had just been a regular seat, we wouldn't have had a sense of time.
Yeah,
we wouldn't have had a sense of the how often it was. Just that one adjective, sticky, gave us a whole perspective of time. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, and I think also that adjective there is the idea of being stuck.
I didn't think of that.
And the idea of also, you know, it's clinging to something you may not need, or it clinging to you. And before you are ready to let go of a situation, sometimes you need to get unstuck.
Did you think of that after the poem?
It's always hard to tell with me when I write, because sometimes I think the poem is wiser than me and it's making decisions that I'm not aware of as I'm crafting the poem. And so did I think sticky was a good adjective? Was it true? Yes. But there was a reason why that was the word. And so I wonder if it was so much that I thought of it afterwards or if the poem thought of it for me.
But just for backstage gossip, was the seat sticky?
It was.
Okay. And I would like to think of you as a 10-year-old. And I would like, that's when we start writing poetry. I've had so many poets on and they all say, you won't believe this, Grace, but I wrote as a child. And I say, no, because everyone says they did. Did you look in the mirror and say, I will be the poet laureate of the United States when I grew up? Did you say that at 10 years of age?
Oh, no. But that would have been so wonderful. No, I did not say that. I did know I wanted to do something in the arts world. I loved to perform. I loved to create things, whether it was songs or dances or poems or any of those things. So I definitely had the full tilt artist pull, if you will, even at 7, 8, you know, however old I was. But I always, you know, I wrote songs a lot for my dog. And I think that was always part of how I entered the world, was through language and the languaging of music.
Did you ever talk into your bedroom mirror and do dialogues?
I did not.
Okay, so you started with music as a performer. And that lyricism is still with you. But what is there still with you that is that 10-year-old that's still with you? What does she want? How much of her is still there? All of her?
I think there's a lot of her that's still there. I think there's some parts that I'm still learning to let go of. I think that the parts that I cherish that are still, you know, with me is that sense of wonder, that sense of the awe of the natural world, what one can find when you sit in silence under a tree, stare at blades of grass, the small world that goes unnoticed. The strangeness of the world, the weirdness of our life experience, that is still with me. I have yet to grow out of that. I think life is a very, very strange thing. And that is definitely with me. I think some things that I could let go of that are still with me as that 10-year-old is the need to please everyone.
But when you look at her, you can say, look what we did, honey.
Oh.
Just look what we did. Look where we are now.
If she, you know, she would be so excited. She is in me so excited and so thrilled. She's doing cartwheels and wearing her leg warmers.
Let's have two more poems in a row. Ada Limón at the Library of Congress, and we are so lucky.
This is a poem that probably refers to that 10-year-old. I remember the carrots. I haven't given up on trying to live a good life, a really good one even. Sitting in the kitchen in Kentucky, imagining how agreeable I'll be, the advance of fulfillment and of desire. All these needs met, then unmet again. When I was a kid, I was excited about carrots, their spidery neon tops in the garden's plot. And so I ripped them all out. I broke the new roots and carried them like a prize to my father, who scolded me rightly for killing his whole crop. I loved them, my own bright dead things. I'm 35 and remember all that I've done wrong. Yesterday, I was nice, but in truth, I resented the contentment of the field. Why must we practice this surrender? What I mean is, there are days I still want to kill the carrots because I can.
And another.
And this is a poem I wrote for my mother.
Do you think the carrying bright dead things has more of your childhood in it or the carrying?
I think they're probably equal. Yeah. That's a great question. I have to think about that. The raincoat. When the doctor suggested surgery and a brace for all my youngest years, my parents scrambled to take me to massage therapy, deep tissue work, osteopathy, and soon my crooked spine unspooled a bit, I could breathe again and move more in a body unclouded by pain. My mom would tell me to sing songs to her the whole 45-minute drive to Middle Two Rock Road and 45 minutes back from physical therapy. She'd say that even my voice sounded unfettered by my spine afterward. So I sang and sang, because I thought she liked it. I never asked her what she gave up to drive me or how her day was before this chore. Today, at her age, I was driving myself home from yet another spine appointment, singing along to some maudlin but solid song on the radio. And I saw Mom take her raincoat off and give it to her young daughter when a storm took over the afternoon. My God, I thought. My whole life, I've been under her raincoat, thinking it was somehow a marvel that I never got wet.
Am I glad you read that one? Mm-hmm. I'll tell you why. Because for 30 years I was mad at my father because he was an immigrant and didn't want his daughters to get in trouble, and he was very strict. Mm. And then after all that, I realized all the things he did, how he made me breakfast. And when you wrote that, you speak for so many people that say, you know what, just think. They drove me to school. They did this. Mm. And at the time, I didn't even know it. Mm. So that is a very popular poem of yours. I don't know if you know which ones are most read or not, actually.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, sometimes people will share them and put them on social media.
Oh, but, yes.
But oftentimes, someone will come up to me and say, oh, this is, you know, I see this poem everywhere. And I think I had no idea that a particular poem is being shared or, you know, you never know. And I don't write them with that intention. I love to connect with people. But when I'm writing them, like for that poem in particular, I was really writing that poem for my mom.
Of course. Of course. And I'm tight with your mom because I love her art.
Isn't she wonderful?
On the front of all of your books. Yes.
Yes.
She rocks.
She does rock.
I'm not kidding.
Yes.
Well, the reason people like your work, and I'm going to tell you now why, because you are prismatic. Mm. There is something for everyone. Mm. You have so many facets that there's not anyone who cannot relate to something. You dance in a honky-tonk bar, and you know the name of every bird and animal on earth. And so, you know, and there's love, there's loss, there's longing, but there's actual situations, and what did you know about being faceted? Mm. Did you know that is the reason you have a big audience?
No.
There is just something for everyone.
I don't know, but that makes sense. I mean, I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier about the idea of strangeness, that looking at those experiences, whatever they may be, whether it's just looking out the window at a bird or whether it's rethinking a childhood being driven back and forth from back appointment after back appointment, thinking this is something I went through, and then realizing, oh no, my parents were going through that, not just driving me, but financially trying to make it work, you know, with their waiting tables and night jobs and all of these things. And I think that it is that looking at the world deeply and with a sense of both insider and outsider.
That is a good point. Also, among all of those, you are a great noticer, not only in your interior world, but you just notice blades of grass. You notice the furred feather and just the watchingness of you. And I think if you didn't do that, you'd be on Mount Olympus and we wouldn't care. That's the problem with people on Mount Olympus. They don't have enough edges, you know, for each of us to cling on to.
Yeah.
I want this edge about the raincoat. Somebody wants this edge about your husband.
Mm.
So it's good to have a lot of edges.
Mm.
And now we'd love to hear another poem. Ada Limón of the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri, and I'm extremely happy.
Mm-hmm. The Unspoken. If I'm honest, a full, pulled chest level close in the spring heat, his every which way coat reverberating in the wind, feels akin to what I imagine atonement might feel like, or total absolution. But what if, by some fluke in the heart and inevitable wreckage, congenital and unanswerable still comes? No matter how attached or how gentle every hand that reached out for him in the vibrant green field where they found him looking like he was sleeping, the mare nudging him until she no longer nudged him. Am I wrong to say I did not want to love horses after that? I even said as much driving back from the farm. Even now, when invited to visit a new foal or rub the long neck of a mare who wants only peppermints or to be left alone, I feel myself resisting. At any moment, something terrible could happen. It's not gone, that coldness in me. Our mare is pregnant right now, and you didn't even tell me until someone mentioned it offhandedly. One day, I will be stronger. I feel it coming. I'll step into that green field, stoic, hardened, hoof first.
So we have motion, always motion. Like the Romantics, they start in one place and they end up in another place. And we always have an idea at the center of your poem. And there's an intellectual idea, but there's a colloquialism that allows us to own that idea. Mm. That's a lot of stuff to do. And I'm sure you don't do it consciously. It's a lot of balls to juggle. I wanted to talk about language a bit because, of course, that's your gift. But at this time in history, you may have noticed that our language is being co-opted. Mm. And we don't know, sometimes the same words are being used that are not true. Mm. I kind of think, I wonder if you believe this, that a lot of people are going to poetry because they can trust the words. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not propaganda and it's not persuasion. I wonder what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think that's really true. I think it's sometimes very hard to trust language. But one of the things that we trust about poetry is that it's where the questions live.
Mm.
And it's where the wonder lives, and it's about an unknowingness. And I think, you know, there's that great Yeats quote about, the argument that we have with another is rhetoric, but the argument that we have with ourselves is poetry. And I think we trust that because we trust that there's a mystery there, an unknowingness. And so much of rhetoric or marketing or anything that's trying to be packaged and sold to us is a false wisdom. And it's false because it has the answers. And if you think you have the answers, we know better.
That's the point. That is the point. But how then does a poet find the truth in herself to be the compass so that... What does it take to get rid of showboating and writing for effect to find the kind of truth you found? What do you do?
Mm.
How do you do it?
Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful and large and marvelous question, Grace. I think for me, it has a lot to do with silence. Most of my poems come out of a moment of deep quiet and silence and what that opens to me, what I'm listening, what I hear in the dark. I also feel like there is a sense that I am always trying to find ways to love and surrender to the world. And I think my body and my mind and often my much worried heart can be at odds with finding a kind of peace and can be in chaos. And so finding that silence and that way of re-loving something is often where poems begin for me.
That tells me quite a bit that I intuited but did not have the language for, and that is there is, when you walk into a room, you bring a stillness with you.
Mm.
And there is that you operate out of. And also, there's no resistance in your poetry.
Mm.
I mean, if it is surrender, it is surrender. Mm. So resistance, I don't know if you and I have the same idea of what that is, but it's a grinding to make someone feel something.
Mm-hmm.
That's not there. Mm. Let's have another poem.
Yes. Salvage. On the top of Mount Pisgah, on the western slope of the Mayacamas, there's a madrone tree that's half burned from the fires, half alive from nature's need to propagate. One side of her is black ash, and at her root is what looks like a cavity hollowed out by flame. On the other side, silvery green broadleaf shoots ascend toward the winter light, and her bark is a cross between a bay horse and a chestnut horse, red and velvety like the animal's neck she resembles. Staring at the tree for a long time now, I am reminded of the righteousness I had before the scorch of time. I miss who I was. I miss who we all were before we were this, half alive to the brightening sky, half dead already. I place my hand on the unscarred bark that is cool and unsullied, and because I cannot apologize to the tree, to my own self, I say, I am sorry. I am sorry I have been so reckless with your life.
Can you believe you wrote that?
Mm.
Can you believe you wrote that? That came through you.
Yeah, I had an experience with that tree. Me and that tree wrote that.
It's clear.
And that tree.
That is so clear. How about form? Mm. You know it all. You've used form, although it's embedded. We don't say it's metric.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested in the crown sonnets you did. I think it was the Lucky Wreck.
Lucky Wreck. Mm-hmm.
Why did you do that? Mm. Did you find that the theme needed to be carried forth? First of all, tell everybody what a crown sonnet is.
Yeah, a crown of sonnet is where you write one sonnet and then the next sonnet begins with the last line of the previous sonnet. A full crown is 14. I wrote technically a half crown, which is 7. But some people will say a crown can be 7. But yeah, it's a wonderful exercise. And this crown came about when I was trying to find a way. It was a story in verse. It was about a couple that was dealing with addiction issues. And what I did was try to figure out how I could write this poem. And I had all of these images. I didn't know where it was going. And then the first couple lines came to me and they started to rhyme. And I realized it was a Petrarchian sonnet.
Mm.
And I thought, oh, here we go. And so when I got to the end of that first sonnet, I realized that with addiction, right, where there is this sort of this formal trap being set, and I realized they couldn't get out of it because of the rhyme scheme and because the crown itself was forwarding the momentum. And so that's how I ended up with that crown of sonnets, that the form dictated not only the content of the poem, but it also gave these constraints that mirrored the constraints of a couple living with addiction.
How long did it take in the making?
About 7 months.
Every day?
I wouldn't say every day, but once it came together, then it was fidgeting and fidgeting and fidgeting and fidgeting.
So you obsessed some of those 7 months.
That in particular poem was very obsessive, yes.
Do you like it?
Yes, and I'm very happy I did it. And so there are times where I set out to write another crown. And to be honest, I feel like it actually came out so full in its own fruition in that form that I worry about approaching another crown because that feels like it was so innate as opposed to, oh, I'm going to sit down and write a crown. Instead, it just came.
I understand that completely. In other words, you did it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be done again, maybe. Well, I think You're going to have a very interesting year. Do you have an idea of what you're going to do as poet laureate?
Well, one of the things that I'm really looking forward to, as we were talking about earlier, is I would love to, just to be sure that I do come back and celebrate the library and be here at the library. I think with the last years of the pandemic, and, you know, even though, of course, we're still living through it, I would like to make sure that the Poetry Office has a little life in it, and bring the Poet Laureate back to the Library of Congress.
Oh, yes. It's been closed up. The shutters mm-hmm. have been closed. And this is a great way to celebrate the end of the pandemic with you. So Ada Limón wrote The Carrying, Bright Dead Things, Sharks and the Rivers. That was about New York. I think Bright Dead Things is about Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Big Fake World, which is highly dramatic. The Hurting Kind, which is full of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. That is such a book of forgiveness. And an animal in every poem, and I think The Carrying has an animal in every poem. Mm-hmm. So she's something else. She really rocks the world. Mm-hmm. Let's have a final poem.
Oh, yes. I'll close with the last poem of my most recent book. And it came right at the beginning of the pandemic, and when isolation was troublesome, and when I was very forsaken, I think, by poetry, and then this poem came. The end of poetry. Enough of osseous and chickadee and sunflower and snowshoes, maple and seeds, samara and shoot. Enough chiaroscuro, enough of thus and prophecy, and the stoic farmer and faith and our father, and tis of thee. Enough of bosom and bud, skin and God not forgetting, and star bodies and frozen birds. Enough of the will to go on and not go on, or how a certain light does a certain thing. Enough of the kneeling and the rising and the looking inward and the looking up. Enough of the gun, the drama, and the acquaintance's suicide, the long-lost letter on the dresser. Enough of the longing and the ego and the obliteration of ego. Enough of the mother and the child and the father and the child. And enough of the pointing to the world, weary and desperate. Enough of the brutal and the border. Enough of, can you see me? Can you hear me? Enough, I am human. Enough, I am alone and I am desperate. Enough of the animal saving me. Enough of the high water. Enough sorrow, enough of the air and its ease. I am asking you to touch me.
The beautiful voice of Ada Limón. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Snippet Fund, Natalie Canavore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.